Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and today we're going to be doing a little bit of a recap of IBC. And granted, we know it was weeks ago, but we've got a couple little tidbits, some good interviews, as well as some insight into stuff beyond the press releases. And to that end, I'm joined by Mike Seymour from Sydney. Mike, how's it going today?
Good, man. How are you?
Fantastic. Fully recovered by this point. If I'm not, there'd be something wrong with that, I guess. But IBC was good. It was very, it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot of stuff. And of course, you know, one of the main reasons I went there, at least one of the highlights of why I went there, was to check out some of the imagery from the RED camera.
Yeah, I've only seen stuff online, but nothing beats actually seeing 4K with your own eyes.
So it was incredible. As you know,
what was it like?
It was beautiful imagery, and it was kind of amusing because I had to basically run from the airport in order to get to the show on time, because I landed at like 10 in the morning and the last screening was at noon. And of course I get there and they don't let me in because they've already begun the screening. I'm like, look, I've flown all the way from the States for this. Come on, please, please. And luckily enough, the lady did her job actually and kept me from going in. But luckily enough, they showed the footage at the end of the session again, so I was able to go in. And it was really quite amazing. I was really impressed. It's granted, it's the first footage off the sensor. There were some visible dead pixels in the sensor. That's, you know, totally to be expected. But according to the folks from RED, they did some minimum of color grading and correction to it, and it looked absolutely outstanding. I mean, as far as a first test, you know, I went from more skeptical to now much more optimistic after having seen it in person. It was absolutely gorgeous.
So even though they like didn't let you in, I don't think that was any reason to steal their camera, dude.
You know what? I had to get back them for that. That was insulting after traveling all that far. But as for those of you who don't know this, it's been on the net the last couple weeks, or was it last week? I guess that some of the prototypes for the RED camera were actually stolen from their offices. And of course, it runs the reactions on the internet, as it usually is, run the gamut from, oh, it was an incredible marketing ploy, to subversive industrial espionage, you know. So quite amusing, all the speculation that's out there in the RED forums.
Yeah, I guess the thing for me, right, is that any of the major camera manufacturers, like the Arris, the Panavisions, those kind of, I mean, it's just such incredible ethical companies. There's no way they'd be involved with trying to nick a prototype. Like, I think it's just some guys nicked it because they could, and I can't possibly believe that any major corporation of the quality of the people like Sony and stuff would ever stoop to doing that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of against the conspiracy theories, and I certainly don't see that it's a good PR ploy, because I mean,
what do you have to gain?
Why would it be? Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, we got broken into, so that'd be a good reason to buy the camera.
they just got done from what I would say was a pretty successful show. Wouldn't you agree? From most comments on the web, you know, there's still the skeptics out there, but they were, you know, very positive. So why would you do that? As far as the espionage,
we're down for camera number 22, right? And I think by the end of the show, there are like 500 people in the queue now.
Yeah, closing right at the end of the month, I believe the reservations are going to be closing at the guaranteed price coming up. So.
I know the lenses are closing.
Yeah, quite interesting.
They also showed a new lens there, right? They discussed a new zoom lens, right?
They sure did. They introduced a new lens there as well, which is quite impressive. In fact, why don't we go ahead and get kind of a catch-up on what happened with RED. I had the good fortune to spend a little bit of time with Ted Shilowitz, who Mike and I have talked about. It's one of our favorite business card titles, which is Leader of the Rebellion.
He's a nice guy. I talked to him at NAB for FX Guide, if you recall. And he certainly is quite accessible, isn't he, John?
He's a nice guy. He really is. So why don't we go ahead and join those comments from Ted.
What we've done since NAB is, you know, we launched there, we showed our industrial design, we told people it was going to change a lot. It has changed a lot. We think for the better. And again, from the feedback we've been getting, people, they're saying, wow, your evolution is fantastic. We're full speed ahead on many, many fronts. We brought our sensor up from nothing, from pure design with our own sensor team, and made it real. Fabbed it out, get the first wafers back, pictures start to come back. Unbelievable. They look great. We're continuing to work towards our engineering targets of having first cameras built by the end of the year and shipping early next year. And, you know, we'll keep people posted on our progress. That's one of the things people have been most happy with, is that we've just been genuine and honest about our processes.
How's the development of the sensor been? Is it, I've heard in developing sensors and so forth, there's a lot of room for error. How's that process been?
We're fortunate that, I guess as we said one day, last couple of weeks, you make your own luck. You put yourself together and you put the right team together and you hope for the best. And you're right, it's high-risk poker when you build a sensor, especially a sensor like this that's never been done before. This is not an existing piece of hardware on the market that you're just modifying. It's brand new. And to actually get the images that we got is... there could have been a very different outcome.
Right.
And we would have been honest and we would have explained to people that these things take time and you know, we're still not to the finish line yet, but all intentions now and everything is looking like we're not going to just live up to expectations, but we're going to exceed them by quite a bit. If you look at these first images and know that we've got quite a ways to go to get them to their final stage, I think most everybody would be happy with the images we shot today. So going to get better from here.
Some of the specific stuff that you've added to the industrial design is really interesting, seeing how you've changed the form factor, made it a little bit smaller, knocked the battery, taken the battery out of the main camera.
We would say that we're probably not the smartest guys in the world, but we know how to listen and we know how to respond, and we think we're inventive, creative, and bold. And we're not afraid to say, you know what, that might not have been a good idea. That's the whole idea of all this constant change, is if you're going to show people an evolution and a development process, they're going to have to know what it feels like, what it is. Now, you guys don't see every step of it. Believe me, you'd go insane. You see the major milestones and when we make major changes. As we evolve the camera, as we think about more how people want to shoot it, easy logic here. Let's slim it up a little bit so it becomes more shoulder mountable, easier for a study cam, easier to put on a tripod. Let's form factor it in a better way. Let's build this rail system that wasn't at NAB at all. It came up after NAB. So that you can hang and put all this stuff. And let's take the battery and the magazine out of the camera because they don't really belong there in the first place. There was an idea for a while. We thought this was a good idea. And then ultimately we decided this isn't actually a good idea. We need that space for other things. So you're going to change that battery a lot. You're going to change that digital magazine. And you can use them as weighting points because the lenses that you're using, these PL mount lenses, are not super lightweight. You know, I mean, these are not a lens you put on an HDV prosumer camera. These things have serious glass in them. So the logic of all this rail system and the battery and the digital magazine is weight distribution. You stretch the rail around, you stretch the rail, and now you've got a different counterbalance point. So it still feels the same to you because you're balancing properly. It's all about balance.
Pretty slick. And as far as delivery dates or target dates for getting the camera actually into people's hands and starting manufacturing?
We'll do the best we can. But ultimately, very first cameras will be built by the end of this calendar year. That's still on track.
Okay.
And we'll start shipping early to mid next year. So, you know, you'll have them as soon as next year.
Well, it was great for Ted to take the time to get us up to date, I think. You know, in fact, all those guys at Red are approachable. You know, that's a great thing about online and in person.
Yeah, one thing that I think is really interesting, and we're not really going to know yet, I guess, is that, like, if you look at, say, an HD camera that's like the XD, you know, the Sony XD format, that's got an incredibly low data rate. I mean, super low data rate, but the images don't look completely shite. And, like, even if you're talking about the data rate, I don't know, from off air, you know, it's like 20 megabits a second or something, right? It's still an HD image. So what matters, of course, is that what's going on with those pixels for a visual effects point of view in terms of keying, compression, and that kind of stuff. Because the thing is, I mean, while I think the images look really brilliant, and there's actually a full res, or not full res, there's a high res download on the web, Red website of a girl blowing smoke rings. It's a weird picture. But anyway, the thing is, I can't really tell yet what it's going to be like for doing keying and visual effects work because it's too hard to work out without actually getting some images. Because, I mean, the data rates are vast, right? But then they're so vast that they have to go through the Red codec because they're being recorded. So if I'm not mistaken, like we're talking about 4K at 60 frames a second is 900 megabytes a second. And then there was, what, like 10 to 1 on that with the Red codec, which is, a wavelet 10-bit next-gen kind of codec to bring that down. So if you had something that was going in at, I don't know, 300 megabytes per second,
yeah, that's
it'd be
the
recording
normal.
At 20...
Yeah, that's the normal 24 frames per second 4K that they're talking about off the sensor
well,
before
that,
compression.
That would go to their new flash or on-camera recorder at more like 27.5 megabytes a second. And that's not a crap number, but it's still like what you're talking about is, for a starter, it's a Bayer image, right? So the 4K is the Bayer sensor. And then we're talking about compression. So I'm not raining on their parade because obviously I really like the Red camera, but... You know, we really need to get our hands on some green screen footage and stuff to look and see what the compression stuff is. Because it's actually a pretty significant part of the problem now, isn't it? Not just what the images look like, but how they sort of are structurally holding up.
Exactly. That's so true. Because getting down from that 325 megabytes per second, and again, we're talking megabytes for those of you who missed that, down to, you know, say the 28 megabytes is really incredible. And as I mentioned in our online article, we have a lot of those numbers that we talk about. But the proof is going to be until we can actually get in and take it to a software app and see what that green screen looks like. But we had a moment also to talk at the Red Camera booth to Graham Natras, who is a really really great guy, really knowledgeable guy, very technical in nature, and he's helping develop the Red Code.
Well, you know, we use his codecs.
Oh, that's
down
right.
at the FXPHD
penthouse.
Tech penthouse. We use that for all of our deinterlacing and video stuff because he makes these nothing to do with Red, but he makes these great Final Cut Pro plugins and. So you actually got to hang out with Graham, did you?
Yeah. Got to hang out with Graham and had my head filled with numbers and theories and codecs and compressors.
He's a geek, isn't he? Really?
He really is.
He's like the sort of geek that other geeks would look at in the shower room with kind of envy.
Yeah, exactly. And just such a personally great guy. So you know what? Why don't we let you find out for yourself and let's listen to what Graham had to say about some of the compression and some of the conversion from RAW into RGB images using the Red Code codec.
Obviously, I mean, we have all your standard 1080p, 720p, 2K, all of these are in RGB modes. But for the sort of digital cinema users, we have RAW 4K recorded on an internal flash memory drive or an external hard drive. And this goes through a what we call Red Code RAW compression system, which does a few clever things. One, because the image is still in a raw state, we can actually leverage much higher compression efficiencies than you would normally get. Because a lot of the times when you do video processing to an image, you're actually doing things which make the image harder to compress. In a traditional video camera, you might add some sharpness, and as we know, sharpness is bad for compression. Also, you may be doing some gains and other things, and we know that that isn't going to increase noise, and of course we all know that noise is bad for compression. So by keeping the video raw, you can leverage that, and then it goes for a very modern, up-to-date wavelet compression system, which is 10-bit depth, and it's a variable bitrate, so it can adapt to whatever the image is coming in within reason, because you're going to a recording medium with a fixed record speed. So I think most users are going to be using that kind of mode, but maybe if you want to do a special effects shot, maybe you want to leverage some of the very high speed modes on the camera, or maybe you just want absolute pristine uncompressed RAW, maybe you want to do your own stuff with the data, so we give you a RAW high speed port. Now, the sensor itself can, at sort of maximum throughput, generate about 1 gigabyte per second of data. Give or take, it's 900 and something of a megabytes per second. It's around about a gigabyte. It's pretty serious. So that's 4520 by 2540 pixels, 12-bit depth. And, you know, as I say, it's really serious to deal with. The images that we're showing here today all went through in the prototype, the equivalent of the raw high-speed port. And you can do it. It's just you need a refrigerator-sized hard drive. You know, it might be very, very good for some specialist applications, but maybe it's not for normal shooting.
What have been any specific challenges that you've had in dealing and creating the compression scheme for the Red camera? Anything that you run into with imagery and acquiring imagery this way?
I think the major challenge has been how to deal with RAW, because none of the standard compression schemes out there actually understand it. They're all expecting either a YCBCR or RGB image. So that's been the major challenge, is figuring that out.
What kind of data rates are we talking about? Say at the raw coming off the camera is what, about 325 megabytes at 24.
Yeah, that's for 24p, and it's also for just 4K, not the full sensor. That's 4096 by 2304, 12-bit depth at 24 frames a second. And because it's raw, we've had a few people saying, well, that number isn't quite right. Well, what they're forgetting is that the sensor is a Bayer pattern color filter array. So it's effectively, when you pull it off, it's like one grayscale image, and then you have to go in and know what the mosaic pattern is, and then you start getting to algorithms to demosaic it. And the way that that works is each color that gets picked up, whether it's on a green pixel, a red pixel, or a blue pixel, it doesn't just pick up green. It'll pick up green and a bit of the colours out in that sort of tonal range as well. And I think a lot of people have seen the graphs of spectral responses of sensors. And this means that although the colour resolution on a Bayer pattern colour filter array is a little bit lower than what you'd normally get if each pixel recorded red, green and blue, you get a very high quality, high resolution LUMA signal. And then what you can do is you can go in and use the LUMA signal to up-interpolate the chroma signal, effectively, and get a very high-quality colour image out. And thinking in the digital stills world, say, you've got a 12-megapixel DSLR. If you want to know what the equivalent sort of megapixel if you had a sensor that picked up both red, green and blue, would probably be a 6-megapixel sensor. Depending on the algorithm, you can do a bit better or a bit worse than that, but it isn't as bad as people seem to think. 4K Bayer is not 2K RGB. It's around 3K. But the fact is, even if it sounds like you're losing something there, it doesn't look it. Everyone's seen DSLR images from your high-end Canons, high-end Nikons. The images are absolutely beautiful. And the philosophy here at Red is we're users of these high-end stills cameras ourselves. We know what the quality of the images is. We use them regularly. And that is the sort of image sort of style and quality that we're aiming for.
Well, you know what? Thanks, Graham, for taking the time to talk to us. And for those of you who were totally thrown by the numbers, I tried to explain that in the number breakdown online, as well as provide a very simplistic diagram of what some of the demosaicing process is of the Bayer.
Hey, John, did you get to see the new viewfinder as well? Because that's always been an issue, hasn't it? Like getting a viewfinder you can focus through when they're not necessarily an optical path. There's a new viewfinder, wasn't there, for the Red camera?
Yeah, actually,
at the show?
Well, I was able to see some prototypes of it as well. So,
okay.
Again, that's an interesting part of that process, isn't it? Actually, just as a side note, this idea that we're kind of observing the whole development process of this camera, right, from technology to the form factor. I mean, a lot of the stuff that Red reacted to has been just input from DOPs and so forth online, and obviously a ton of interviews from them. And they're really trying to design this camera not necessarily being bound by things that have been done before. I think that's really interesting, don't you?
Yeah, no, definitely. It'll be cool to see. And I think we're still on schedule to see cameras actually. Real cameras out beginning of next year, right?
Yeah, they're talking now the April, May time frame, March, April, May time frame. They're going to have some ones up and so forth for testing around the end of the year, apparently, but shipping to the first customers, hopefully us included, around
us?
NAB time frame. But
so
again,
I'm going to do a hopeless cross-promotional plug here and say that one of the things we want to do is, should it all work and happen and be as remarkable as it looks like it could be, then we'd be able to provide a lot of Red training over at PhD, so that people wanting to move into that for visual effects work would have some pipelines, because there's a lot of pipeline issues. I mean, the data rates are large, very large, and we really haven't solved the whole pipeline process, you know, to deal with that kind of bandwidth. I mean, there's a lot of stuff from the codecs.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Recording devices.
It sure is interesting. Yeah. Again, you talk about the 325 megabytes off the sensor, and that's just at 24. You get it down to 25 megabytes, which, you know, you can record it to a standard SATA hard drive, so that's great and all. But then you got to take that, at least in the beginning, until manufacturers start recording or supporting their, you know, raw images, you take that into the Red Cine product where you debayerize it, do your color correction, scale it, and then output it in the codec of your choice. So, you know, you've got multiple copies of the data. a non-real-time workflow, right? So really a lot of interesting things to consider looking at the workflow in the future. And this kind of stuff actually applies to data, you know, data type workflows anyway.
Hey, on that front, did you get to see the guys that produced the Codex location recorder?
Yeah, we saw that. We dropped by their booth at NAB and ran into them again at IBC. And it's, looking great. They're continuing on with the development. They're actually, aesthetically, there's a slightly new form factor that's actually even cooler than the first one. But for those of you who don't know, it's a really an interesting product designed from the ground up to be a field recording-based device, right? I mean, it's designed to be taken in the field. It's got sealed drives and shock-protected and so forth. And it's
the,
just cool.
The URL, I think, is... Yeah, the URL, if you want to see it, is Codex Digital. So it's CODEXdigital.com. And, yeah, it's HD, 2K, and 4K recording. And, in fact, dual 2K, like you'd have two Genesis or whatever feeding it and recording simultaneously. But that's something that isn't necessarily related to Red, though I believe they're a Red partner. So, again, one of those things that we're going to have to get our heads around as we try and work out the workflow.
Yeah, and as Graham noted in his interview, I think it was Graham's mentioned that, you know, you still can record that raw, you know, uncompressed footage right off the camera, but you're going to need some serious hardware to do that, right? So,
yeah.
I think it's going to be, again, it's going to be interesting going forward. And I think I talked to you about this, Mike. You know, there really is a lot of skepticism on the web. And I just think it's a really difficult process to go through, right? I mean, I don't mean to take anything away from them. But what I think, and we've all of us at EffectSide have worked for, you know, kind of entrepreneurs who've, you know, wanted to see something happen. And sometimes when you have a single person like that, like Jim Gennard, leading a process like that with a vision and the drive to do it, you know, you can make a lot of things happen.
I think that part of it is the price, right? The part of it is it seems an extraordinarily low price. And I think I said this before in one of the earlier podcasts, that if you're going to make a new camera right now, if you priced it at like $150,000 or $300,000, you're only going to sell tops about 50 of them. I mean, there just isn't a market out there for another high-end digital production full-on camera. I mean, there just isn't that much need for feature film. You know, I mean, it seems like a lot, but in fact, there's about 500 cameras worldwide that are just working, and that's about it, really. It's not like there's millions of them. So the only way to make money would be to make a camera like this and appeal to a wide audience, and therefore, you know, make your money by mass producing as opposed to sort of small production runs. So, I just prefer to be the guy who's the glass half full and the glass half empty.
Yeah, exactly.
We have some listeners like Andreas who claim that I'm naive and stupid, but he's a much cleverer guy than I. But I still say that I want to be part of the believer group, not the cynic group.
And again, it's not tangible, but that's where I don't discount some single entrepreneur like Jim, who's
totally.
Just really gung ho about something and will make it done. I mean, you know. So again, it's just something we'll keep our eyes on. Hopefully, we'll have more great news in the future. And again, it was from my standpoint, it was just great to see the footage moving at IBC and have it to be of such high quality.
What else did you say?
Well, you know what? I want to mention that I dropped by the Blackmagic Design booth as well, because we just wanted to talk to them because
my newest bestest friends.
Yeah, no kidding.
I love Blackmagic, man. Oh my God, they made such a difference. It's like maybe not necessarily your first and foremost sexiest thing being video IO or whatever, but in terms of my lifestyle, oh my God, I have a life again thanks to them.
So. Yeah, let me explain. we have our sister training site of fxphd.com, and so we do a lot of online QuickTime training and so forth, and we record the UIs for things. Well, previously we were just using screen grab software and editing using QuickTime Player Pro, cutting paste, Command C, Command V, until I developed a workflow using the HD link card. So we use Final Cut to capture stuff coming from the DVI output of a monitor right into Final Cut Pro at HD using the DeckLink card, edit it, add our titles, do whatever we need, and then export using compressor. And it's just, it has literally made life so much better for us. And we've been really happy with them. So I know Mike especially has been enjoyed that as well.
Yeah.
After I hooked him up on my last visit down there.
I know, you totally nailed it, man. It's like full credit to you. But hey, You also, they've got a new thing out, haven't they?
Yeah, like that's what I want to drop by. They're just check out. They have this a $249 HD card, which is called the Intensity card, and it uses the HDMI input and output. So it allows you to capture things if you want HDMI. And there were several new Sony cameras that actually have an HDMI output on them, so you can actually capture before that gets compressed on tape. And if you want, you can even output your images onto some kind of monitor that has an HDMI input. So Grant Petty has been one of, again, another friend of FX Guides for a long time. He's from Down Under.
Yeah, he's an Australian, man. He's definitely got it. He really gets it, though, doesn't he? He totally gets it. Like, even to the price thing, he was at the forefront of just pricing this stuff to
not
be
like DVS
accessible.
Yeah, exactly. So we caught up with him to find out more about the new Intensity card.
From our point of view, when we saw HDMI appear on the new Sony cameras and things like that, we thought, well, this is really quite exciting. It's like kind of like consumer SDI. It's digital, it's uncompressed, it's full 1920 by 1080. Yeah, it's limited by the quality of the cameras themselves, but we can kind of now bring consumer products up into a professional space and let people work uncompressed. So there's, you know, a few big advantages to that. Firstly, I mean, of course, you can just use a big screen TV if you're editing in HDMI, in HDV, or uncompressed. I mean, we've got a lot of designers who are working with After Effects. You can real-time RAM preview out of it into a big screen TV. It's $250, so it's an extremely cheap product to put into lots of workstations. But the thing that's also exciting has been able to capture from the camera uncompressed. You can take the video straight from the CMOS sensor, and it's giving you a higher quality level because you avoid the HDV compression. So Intensity is, a really exciting product for us.
Yeah, it's a very interesting product. Now, you've had a wide range of products from the past also that are applicable to a lot of our listeners, the hardcore high-end compositor and designer as well. Why don't you run through your kind of offerings that might be of interest to someone looking to use them?
Yeah, we've got a few good models there now. We pretty much cleaned out our product line 6 months ago. With PCI Express coming along, we thought it was a good opportunity to combine high definition and PCI Express into one card. And that was just ideal for the new Macs and PCs that are extremely fast. I mean, we're getting a whole new level of speed now. Decklink HD Extreme is a product that's been shipping for 6 months. It's HD SDI, but it also switches to SD SDI immediately. And it's also got an analog component on it, which also switches between high definition and standard definition, remote control, four-lane PCI Express. That just connects to everything.
Yeah, so I think that Intensity card is actually really has some interesting promise in it. One misnomer about putting an HD card in your PC or Macintosh is that just because you put it in doesn't mean you can actually capture that data. You've got to have a really good hard drive subsystem. I'm borderline getting by with a four-drive SATA RAID array on my G5, but you can't just, you know, get an HD card, throw it in your G5, and be good to go. So we asked Graham about this, and he talked a little bit about the hard drive stuff, as well as some interesting developments on the Windows platform to help you deal with some really good high-quality imagery, but at lower data rates.
The problem, of course, is you've got so much data, you can't put it down on the internal disk. So you've got to use a disk array, and we've been working with people like Cipro and Apple with Xserve RAIDs. But also, we've found the new Mac Pros, you can do some of the lower frame rates in 8-bit on 3 stripe disks internally, but you've got to use a disk array to do that. But there's also some other options we've got where we can work with DVC Pro HD on the Mac if you've got Final Cut installed, so we can compress to that in real time. That allows you to go down on the internal disk. And on the Windows side, and particularly long-form guys need this who are doing programming work, we've now got a full-resolution JPEG codec, so we can get the data. We needed a codec that would give us lightweight CPU use, get it down on the internal disk, but it had to be full-resolution HD. And some of the DV-based codecs aren't full-resolution, they're only 1440 wide. You put a graphic on that, you've got a nice After Effects render, and it looks beautiful with some nice detail. You drop that on the timeline, and it suddenly stretches it down at 1440. You see it. You see it in diagonal kind of detail in fonts and things like that, and it doesn't look good at all. I really hate that. So I'm really happy that we've got that codec in Windows now. And on the Mac side, of course, we've got all the codecs in QuickTime.
Is the codec on the Windows, is that CPU-based? Because you do have the photo JPEG on the Mac systems. But I have a quad, and I find difficulty in keeping up with the bandwidth for the compression via the CPU when using the high-quality JPEG. Any hopes for seeing something improved on the Mac, so high-quality compression?
Yeah, we are looking at moving that codec to the Mac side as well. We originally did it on the Windows side because it was we wrote it ourselves. And we wrote it because we most needed a codec on Windows. We didn't have anything on Windows at all. On the Mac, we had DV Super HD. But, of course, that's not 1440 wide. So we're looking at actually seeing we move that across to the Mac side, which we should be able to do. And the codec we've written is extremely optimized. It's taken us months of work. So we can keep the CPU load right down. We looked at some other compression schemes, but they're just too CPU intensive. And you want to keep that CPU spin, you know, free. But when you're capturing and playing back, you do actually have the full CPU available most of the time. So it's a good codec.
Yeah, it's good to hear, Grant. I actually, I should try and hook up with him the next time we're at NAB. Hey, John, there's some other interesting stuff in 3D tracking that's been happening around the place. Like, did you see the guys from RealViz? Because they've got some interesting, facial tracking stuff.
I wandered around looking for them, not believing that the show guide where they were not listed was true. But in fact, they didn't actually make it to IBC. A lot of the software-only companies end up not making it to IBC, unlike NAB and so forth.
Oh, really?
It's maybe more giant satellite dishes and mobile units. I mean, mobile units are kind of fun to stroll through every once in a while, see what those are like. But basically all the stuff there that's kind of related to what we do in Visual Facts is in one hall, hall number 7. And over the years, it just keeps getting more and more compacted in that hall. So you've got this one hall where you can see everything. But RealViz was not there. But why don't you tell us a little bit about that? I think it's pretty interesting.
Oh, they've just got
product.
This Movie Memento thing, which is a automated tracking for doing like performance capture. So rather than having to get a whole lot of elaborate cameras, I mean, I haven't used it. I'm just keen to hear about it.
Yeah,
it's. I think we'll definitely follow it up separately with the RealViz guys, because it's the idea that you would have like several cameras just aimed at someone giving a performance, and then using a combination of, I guess, tracking 3D camera moving type technology and also the triangulation stuff you see in, say, an image modeler. They come up with complex mesh animations of, say, faces. I think there's a move in the 3D tracking world. We saw it with PF Track 3.5 and stuff to doing object tracking. And then it's a small leap from object tracking to motion capture kind of tracking without specialist rigs. And I've got to say, the thing about that is it's great having those specialist rigs. Obviously, you're a wetter or something. It's like a no-brainer.
Right.
But for anybody else, it'd be great to be able to do a small amount of, you know, motion capture without having to invest in the, you know, $200,000 studio. So, I think the Foundry that was there, or were they not there?
Yeah,
as well?
No, the Foundry was there for sure. They premiered.
Cool stuff.
Yeah, they do have some cool stuff. They showed off their Furnace 3 plugins, which we had the good fortune to actually get a sneak preview of towards the end of last year when we did an FX Guide live event in LA in conjunction with them, which was a blast. But one of the cool things about the new Furnace 3 and only the Furnace 3 for Autodesk is this new Correlate plugin, which is partly a brainchild of you, I believe, Mr. Seymour.
Well, that's not really my brainchild, but certainly I was
part of it. Yes, exactly.
Well, Simon deserves all the credit and the guys over there. But yeah, so we were basically pointing out to them that. Did you like it, by the way? Because I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I liked it, and it seems to be even getting even better from what I saw at IBC.
Oh, good. Just explain it for people that don't know. We'll try and put a video up that we did on it. But if you've got a camera and you want it to align to another between two takes, so we've got take one, take two, I want them to align. Now, if I motion control, then it moves perfectly. The camera is at the same point in space at the same point in time in both takes. Obviously, they line up. That's the whole point of motion control. But if you did two takes where, let's say, you had a dolly track and you moved along it trying to be accurate, and then you did another take, you know, 5 minutes later, again, trying to be accurate, they wouldn't line up because there's no way you'd push the darn thing exactly the same. And so you'd end up with both slight differences in movement of like where the camera was pointed and also some differences in time. It would get to the end slightly ahead of where it was. And I pointed out to the guys that what they were in a good position to do is solve that, because they have technology for tracking stuff. And they have brilliant technology for optical flow retiming stuff. And I said, so what you really want to do is both retime and track simultaneously, so that you say, you know what, I'm going to make this what I call the cleanish pass and align it to the hero pass, and I'm going to move it in space and move it in time so the two get locked the whole way through. And so you end up with like a poor man's motion control where the second pass is digitally changed in its timing, like up and down, slow and fast, and repositioned both just in terms of, you know, a 1D and a rotational thing. So you get two plates that perfectly line up. And I suggested this to the guys and hounded them because I thought, you know, that's a very hard thing for us to do manually, but a great thing for them to do because they have control over both things. And they actually went a step further. I said, well, not only can we do that, but why don't we do it so that we use our deflickering technology and our color matching technology so that we'll make both plates actually have the same exposure. And so they'll be not only the same in time and space, but actually also the same you know, look, so you could do a paint back, and the classic, you imagine I would have a shot of me talking to me, and we're shooting it outside. Well, you do the two passes, and when you come back in post, you can lay them up, and they will line up, and because the lighting is going to match, the movement and the timing is going to match, even though it wasn't a locked-off camera, we could have me happily talking to myself while the camera moved past me. And I mean, I was just thrilled to death when the guys came up with a prototype of it, and as you said, John, it's only in Flame, and this is not some kind of weird marketing thing. It's simply that the SDK that was developed for Shake doesn't have a lot of access into the time base of a clip. Shake is inherently designed to be a many layers at this one point in time kind of app, and so the SDK that lets the developers write software doesn't let them actually easily get access to clips up and down the timeline. In fact, there's one Foundry clip that you add it as a node in Shake, and you actually look inside the node. I had 73 file ins appear because it was trying to access up and down the timeline by just producing a gazillion file in nodes. And so it's just impossible to do this very, very complex problem in Shake. So they've got it happening in Flame. But that's worth it alone, that one plugin. You know, that's not a piece of eye candy. That's a serious tool in the toolbox, and I'm glad that was going well for them at IBC.
Yeah, it really was. And as Mike mentioned, we've got a link to a little introductory movie to that we did from the DVD for you guys to take a look at. So check out the online article for that as well. The Foundry also introduced a new Tinderbox 4 box plugins for their effects system, as well as support for After Effects and their 32-bit processing pipelines. So all the Tinder plugins for After Effects are all now 32-bit capable, which is quite a big deal because a lot of those effects that they have in their Tinder boxes really stand to benefit from that because of the type of effects that they are.
Hey, was there much stuff for After Effects? You were talking about, you know...
Yeah, you know what, there was... I said there weren't many software companies there, but there was a small one, which has become a favorite of mine, which is the guys at Gridiron Software.
What do they do?
They do things to speed up rendering in After Effects. They started with distributed network rendering stuff, and then at the end of last year, it came out with a product called Nucleo Pro, which, when you rendered a file or a composition within After Effects, it would actually distribute that rendering among the different processors of your host machine. So for instance, in my case, I got a G5 quad, right? Set something up in After Effects and hit render. You watch the CPUs for that, it's like 25% of each CPU is all that's being used natively in Adobe After Effects. Their optimization for multi-proc machines isn't all that great. Well, buy this Nucleo Pro plugin, throw it in, you peg your CPU processes 100% on all the CPUs. So needless to say, your speed up in rendering is incredible. So big fans of that. And their Nucleo Pro plugin actually adds a couple really cool things to that. First off, it adds background rendering. When you render in After Effects, you're locked out of the app. Well, with Nucleo Pro, you can hit render, and you'll set up a background render, and we'll use the available CPU power that you have on your multiproc system to render in the background while you continue working. And you know what? I've used it. I've been using it, and it really does a nice job of managing the interference. You know, it's not going to really have a huge drag on what you're working on in the foreground app. It does a nice job of being very nice to the Adobe After Effects applications. That's pretty cool, I think. It's also got some other features which involve the idea of while you're working on one part of your composition, it's off rendering the rest of your composition in the background. So let's say you've got like a 15-20 second comp or something, and you're only changing the first five. Well, maybe by the time you're done working on that first five, the whole rest of your comp is finished. So really, really interesting.
Cool.
Really cool. And again, I did a QuickTime overview of that product as well that you can check out in our online article.
Is that Intel? I mean, is that Universal or is that PC? What is that?
Yes, it's universal Windows and Mac. So all of the above. So I know After Effects is big on the Windows platform because, especially up until the debut of the Intel processors on Mac, the Windows version was really, honestly, faster than the Mac version. So, but if you have a multi-core system on Windows, Nucleo works for you as well on that. So pretty cool product, I think. Shout out to them. Yeah, it's a good thing. We also, in our, just a heads up, in our online store, we have a couple more wiretap tools. One that we missed in our first go round from IBC that was developed in part by Alan Letary, and then also a look at a further look at the product on tap, which includes accessing your stones to create a review and approval flash file that people can draw on and add comments and so forth. It's kind of cool. So be sure to check out those that are online exclusives, as we like to say. Actually, we don't like to say that, but it seems like a cool marketing term.
Yeah, you know, whatever. It's that thing we're really known for our cool marketing.
No, very true. All
right, but we're known for being geeky and proud of it. So was that about it? I mean, did you get to have a? I mean, was there any? Did you see anyone? I mean, was there any familiar FX guide kind of friends of faces over there, like JF
JFP was over there, Jean-François Panisset, who was used to be at Discrete, just a really great guy all around.
Sony
And Sony after that. So he went from Discrete to Sony. Didn't let me finish the story.
I'm sorry.
From Flame News days, he's just the kind of guy who would always help users out, provide input, just a really great software engineer, knew the SGI systems in and out. So he's on a 2-month tour of Europe right now, hopping from city to city, seeing all those people he met on Flame News. So that was kind of cool to see JF. He's doing well. Of course, had a great Flame gathering again at Hectic Electric. I'd like to thank those guys for their kindness in hosting that event, as well as a little go-karting event that has now become routine for some of us over there. We go out and ride go-karts on a track one night after the show, which is great fun.
Really?
Yeah.
How cool was that?
It was fun. A good time. So there was a little bit of fun, but again, you know, those shows are so quick. There's so much to see. But hope in our 3 or 4 articles we did from about IBC, we gave you guys a good perspective on what was cool at the show.
Would you say that IBC is a strong show? Is it waning at all, or is it?
It's a very strong show. It keeps growing every year. Yeah. As I mentioned, it's not a lot of those smaller software companies are there, right? You know, it's not like Seagraph or something like that, and it's not like the scale of NAB, which is just bigger than you or I can actually handle. You know, it's just overwhelming. But I really like IBC because while it's growing, it's not quite as busy, and it provides a really good opportunity for users to speak directly with people at the companies because it's not quite as crazy and overrun with people like us who visit the show. It's just not as crowded, so you have much better contact with individuals at the various companies, you know, at the show. So even Apple sends in people from Cupertino and Santa Monica as well to the show, so it provides a great opportunity to touch base with those guys, especially for our European listeners, obviously, who can't make it over.
I forgot to ask you about Apple. Did you meet up with any of the Apple guys?
Yeah, they're doing well. They were showing a new version of Final Cut, which had some new features in it. I'm getting
Dion
old in my memory. Yeah, Dion was there, and
cool.
Yeah, it was good to see him. He's the manager of I'm not sure what his official title, but manager of the Pro Applications, and a good guy. And I know a lot of our FX PhD users went up to him to mention that they enjoyed taking the Apple Shake classes on our site as well, and really gave us he came to me and was blown away by the number of people who came up and mentioned to him that they were students at FX PhD, which is nice to see.
You know what I reckon we ought to do, John? I reckon we ought to, I don't know if it's going to be possible or not, but I reckon it'd be good to get over to London, because I mean, if you and I could get over to London sometime and just meet up with a few of these people and both at facilities and at the equipment companies, and see if we can
do some interviews. You know what I'm going to say. I'm a travel slut, you know.
Oh, really?
I love traveling. So, yeah, I think it's one of my favorite things about the website is traveling around, meeting people in the various areas. And I think that would be a great idea to kind of do a European tour and hit some of the main cities over there to talk to with manufacturers and, you know, artists as well, find out what's going on in those markets. I think that'd be a great idea.
If you're listening to this podcast and you're based in, say, somewhere close to London, like London, Paris, that kind of Germany area, and you're at a facility, drop us an email and we'll see if we can't get over and come around and do some interviews with some local production companies. I'm really fascinated. I used to live and work in the UK, but it's been a few years since I've been back professionally, and there's been some great work coming out of Europe.
Really fantastic work, and it's something too that's really great for people. You tend to get focused on what you're working on and kind of the production community within your own country, and it's nice to see, number one, that a lot of the parallels and problems and concern you have in your job are universal in nature, right? You know, the same stresses and pressures, but also to see the kind of market and see the difficulties in approaching, you know, the film market or higher end market in some of the smaller countries as well. I think it'd be really an interesting angle to explore for us. I've enjoyed that aspect in discussing the business with artists from those countries.
It's hard when you're at a trade show to get to facilities and stuff, but I think we just see if we couldn't get our butts over there away from a trade show and actually spend some time and do some interviews over there. I think it'd be fun. So we'll see if we can do that, because we do a lot of interviews, obviously, with the podcast and stuff, and it'd be nice to do a few out of Europe, I think.
I think so, too. Well, I think that's about all the time we got for this week. Mike, you got anything to add?
No, just I'm warming to this idea of going to Europe, so please do email me. I'm serious, man.
Exactly. We are
very
serious.
If you're listening to this,
serious.
Then you want to... yeah, no, that's great, John. Thank you so much. It was really informative, and I felt like I was there, man.
Thanks. Also, be sure to check out the online article as well for those links and those movies that we did about some of the stuff we talked about today. So for our buddy Jeff Huser, who is hard at work in Los Angeles, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.